Next on RadioSaintPete.com with audio courtesy of St. Pete Catalyst, Dr. Ray Arsenault. Dr. Arsenault is the John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida. Today, Dr. Arsenault will talk about his comprehensive biography of Arthur Ashe, known as the Jackie Robinson of tennis, a legend on the court, and a civil rights activist. Dr. Arsenault spoke last month at the Vinoy Business Alliance. Here is Dr. Arsenault.
So I've been going around the country for the last few months pretty steadily at various book festivals and various lectures everywhere from the Smithsonian to the Clinton Library to the Mercantile Library in Cincinnati and places in Boston and New York and lots more coming. But it's really nice to be the local guy here today. I see so many friends. It's really, really great. Those of you who know me know I've been talking ad nauseum about Arthur Ashe for the last decade. I know my friends were so gratified when I actually finished this book so they wouldn't have to hear about this all the time. The old joke, which one of my friends offered, I think it actually started when I spent 9 years writing Freedom Riders. They came up with the line, "You've been working on that book a long time. Do you realize that people have been born and have become sexually active since you started that book?" It's almost literally true, I think. But both the Freedom Riders book and Arthur Ashe were real labors of love. And I must say also the book I did in between, it's called The Sound of Freedom, which is about Marian Anderson, the great black contralto, and her battle with the DAR in 1939 when they wouldn't let her sing in Constitution Hall. And she gave the first major kind of concert at the Lincoln Memorial on Easter Sunday in 1939. It was one of the, it's sort of equivalent almost what happened when people defended her right to sing in Washington, D.C. It was not unlike, Jackie Robinson breaking the color line in Major League Baseball. It was one of these incidents that proved that racism was a national problem. It was a stain on the national honor because all this took place in Washington, D.C., not Birmingham or Jackson, Mississippi or St. Petersburg. And by the way, that book is being made into an American Masters 2-hour documentary right now. I've been doing interviews for it. It'll be out, I think, next year through WNET in New York, PBS. But I'm here to talk about Arthur. I mentioned in my prologue that it took me a while to actually call him Arthur. I couldn't bring myself to just say Arthur. I had such deep respect for him. But finally, we had such an intimate relationship. And in fact, one of the things that I tried to do in a very long book, this is it, so you can see it's kind of a weightlifting course in addition to being a book. And this is the book after 250 pages have been edited out. Okay. This is the brief version. I pointed out that I really felt after spending 9 years with him, going to bed thinking about him, waking up thinking about him, that I deserve to be on a first name basis. I think it's fitting for him too. There are some biographical subjects I think which you always keep a distance. And even though Arthur was known as being very cool, and in 1968 when he won the first U.S. Open, afterwards Life magazine ran a cover story, and the title was "The Icy Elegance of Arthur Ashe." The icy elegance. And so he long had that notion of being so even-tempered, almost too good to be true. Oh, he never seemed to raise his voice. He never seemed to lose his temper. Never held a grudge. Never said anything negative about anyone, except Jimmy Connors. I'll talk to that later. In some of the interviews I've done on the book, they've asked me, "Well, what's the most surprising thing you found out about Arthur Ashe?" I knew his tennis statistics. I knew he was a great champion. I knew he was the Jackie Robinson of men's tennis, which I think is a point that can't be made too many times, because he was a Jackie Robinson all alone his entire career, and there was no Serena Williams, no Venus Williams, Althea Gibson was gone, no other black player on the men's tour. So from 1960s through 1980, when he retired, he was all by himself. So think about that. He's a Jackie Robinson, but there's no Willie Mays, there's no Hank Aaron, oh, no Larry Doby. He's by himself. So he had to negotiate this world, which he seemed to do effortlessly. People just marvel at how serene he seemed to be in these sometimes difficult social situations. But I think the main thing I discovered in the book that shocked me was actually how turbulent he was inside. That on the inside, I think he was a driven man. In some ways, like Jackie Robinson. And those of you who know the story of Jackie Robinson, you know, he died of diabetes and hypertension in his early 50s. And many people thought it had something to do with the fact that he had to sort of sublimate or repress his real feelings during those early years with the Dodgers. You know, Branch Rickey told him, look, you can't yell back, you can't fight back, you can't even, you know, grimace. You just got to sit there and take it. And Jackie Robinson did for those first few years. Then Rickey sort of took the handcuffs off and he could be like a normal person. But I think Arthur had a version of that and didn't really let people know. But those who knew him really well knew that he had this incredible passion to make a difference, really. It's what we always tell our children and our students, you know, that's the kind of life you want to have. But he never seemed to be able to satisfy himself. He never did enough. I think part of it was that as a young athlete, until he was 25, you know, I hope you know the basic story. We can talk later. We don't have time now. But, you know, he was born into poverty in Jim Crow Richmond in 1943. And was, you know, really tough upbringing. Even though he was one of the best young players in the country, he was not allowed to play against whites at all in Richmond. In fact, he had to leave his senior year and went to his coach was looking for a more racially tolerant community. So where did he go from Richmond? St. Louis, Missouri. Think about Ferguson and all that. But at least there, the inner city parks program run by you may have heard of the Buckholz brothers, who were very fine pro players back in the 70s and 60s, and Butch Buckholz. Anyway, their father ran this program, and so he kind of opened the doors for Arthur, and so he could actually play indoors and play against whites, and it was an eye-opening year, and it set the stage for him going off to UCLA, where he became, of course, the NCAA champion and went on to fame and fortune. But it was all a very improbable journey. I think the thing to remember is that when Arthur was beginning to think about having a life as a tennis star, actually even making a living, it really wasn't even conceivable for most whites, let alone for a black man. Oh, I mean, this is before open tennis. You know, open tennis doesn't begin until 1968. They were they had to be amateurs, or they were called shamateurs, right? They took money under the table. And I mean, there were a few on the pro tour, like Pancho Gonzalez, and who could make money, but by and large, you couldn't. And so Arthur was really a big part of the move to open tennis in 1968. He was the founders of the Association of Tennis Professionals. He was in all the early negotiations. It's really fitting that he won the first U.S. Open. And he was one of the creators of modern tennis, which is really kind of interesting that he always thought of himself as an outsider. But he, in some ways, he made himself the ultimate insider and in the tennis world. But like a lot of young athletes, he was sort of self-absorbed. At least his father was a very strict disciplinarian, and his coach, the famous Dr. Johnson, the black doctor from Lynchburg, Virginia, who discovered Althea Gibson first and then Arthur, had this rigid code for all of their young black tennis players. Said, we're looking into the future. We can't afford any racial incidents. We can't afford any conflict. So if that white boy hits the ball just out, you call it in. Okay, it's not worth it. And so that's kind of the code that Arthur had to. You always smiled, you never complained, you never questioned a call, and he was pretty much that way his whole career, just a paragon of sportsmanship. What he felt inside may have been different, but one of the telling stories I remember early on, he got to play in a U.S. LTA Lawn Tennis Association tournament in Baltimore when he was about 13 or 14. And actually there was another young black player who went in with him, and they actually made it to the finals. So unexpectedly, no black had ever played in this tournament. All of a sudden, the two finalists, it's like Venus and Serena playing each other, you know? And so Arthur won, but they canceled all of the trophy presentations and everything. And so he came back out of the locker room and the trophies were just, everybody was gone and they're sitting on the table. You know? And there were just so many of those kind of maybe minor irritants, but you can imagine they would accumulate through a lifetime. And as I said, even though everything seemed to be effortless for him, late in life, he contracted AIDS from a blood transfusion. He had a heart condition that killed him. Well, the AIDS killed him ultimately, but he became HIV positive in 1983. He died in 1993. And he knew he had AIDS in 1988. No idea until then. But he wrote a final autobiography. He wrote four autobiographies. Isn't that amazing? So the notion of writing four autobiographies, and a person only lives to be 49. Thank God he did. I could not have written the book I did. I saw him play a couple of times, but I never actually got to interview him. I interviewed pretty much everybody else that knew him, but he was so candid, brutally candid. He, in the last one, it was called Days of Grace, which he co-wrote with Arnold Rampersad, who's this very distinguished English professor. Used to be at Princeton, just retired from Stanford. It was number one on the bestseller list the 6 months after Arthur died. And in there, he points out, don't feel sorry for me for getting AIDS. And I don't want your sympathy or pity. It's just the luck of the draw. And by the way, that's not the greatest burden of my life, dying of AIDS. He said race is the biggest burden of my life. And I think even people who knew him really closely, like his agent, Donald Dell, and he had many of his very best friends were white, like Charlie Passarell, his roommate, great player from Puerto Rico. They were roommates at UCLA. And they were shocked. Several of them talked to him and said, Arthur, is that really true? You never really let us know that. And it's really poignant how he tried to say that he had this deep sense of the legacy of slavery. And although, as I was mentioning, early in his life, he was a self-absorbed athlete. And then in 1968, in the spring, when Dr. King was assassinated and Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, and he was a friend of Bobby Kennedy's, and he was a great admirer of Dr. King's, something snapped in him, you know? He really couldn't explain it, but he just got this sense that, you know, I have a responsibility to speak out, that I have this privileged existence now within the Black community, and I've got to give back, and I've got to use my fame and fortune as a platform to do something meaningful. And he turned towards activism, his own style of activism. He was very deliberative. As I said, he never raised his voice. He was not emotional, but he was relentlessly intellectual. He really was a public intellectual beyond any other person in the world of sports, for sure. You know, he collected first editions. He was absolutely compulsive about doing the New York Times crossword puzzle every day. He had to finish it, and he would often do it in the locker room. You can imagine the scene of Jimmy Connors looking over his shoulder and saying, "What are you doing?" notion of any of the other pros. Maybe Nastasi was kind of an intellectual as well, but he was just intent on making up for lost time, really. So he devoted almost every waking hour to some kind of philanthropy. I mean, he never said no. Bob Devin is famous for saying the answer is always yes. Well, Arthur was like that. You know, he would, if you look at his daily logbook, you can't imagine that any human being could travel that much to inner city workshops or, you know, fundraisers, or he never accepted any money. You know, he'd fly to Los Angeles, he'd fly to Miami, he'd fly to New York. He loved to do those clinics with those inner city kids, and oftentimes he'd have appointments, and they'd say, "Arthur, it's getting late, you got to go." And he would say, "No, no, no, I got to give this kid a little more time," you know, and. You know, he made them feel like they were the center of the universe. And he really had this, I think, gift. A gift for friendship and a gift for generosity. I knew almost none of this when I started the book. I've been a fan of his. My tennis partner in graduate school in Boston was a man named Jim Horton, who looked like Arthur's twin. They were both born in 1943. Jim was 6'1", 155 pounds, same African-American coloration. He had the same topspin backhand, which was thankful because I didn't have any backhand at all. So he introduced me to the cult of Ash. In fact, once we were at the U.S. Pros in 1972 in Boston, and Ash was about to play Tom Auker, the Flying Dutchman. But they were still in the locker room. And so we were there, a whole bunch of us, and including my sister-in-law, who was kind of a practical joker. And Jim, my friend, always dressed just like Ash. Catalina sports clothes, the head racket. He looked just like Ash, and he's ready to go. He's just going. He's not supposed to be playing. He's just supposed to be a fan. So anyway, my sister-in-law Susan yells out, "Arthur," to Jim. There must have been 150 or 200 people just on him, just assuming he was Ash, of course, and out with their programs for him to sign the autographs. And, of course, Jim did. He said, "Start signing. Yours truly, James Oliver Horton." You can see the people looking at it. And I was standing right next to him, you know, and he goes on with this about 3, 4, 5 minutes, and then finally the real Arthur Ashe comes out and pointing over at this imposter, you know, and... I think it was the greatest day in Jim's life. Well, the point I was making, I think that even Jim had no idea the depths of Arthur's commitment, things he would do. And this is a classic example of it. Although I should start, though, just very quick anecdote before that, what started my whole research on this book. So I'm on Martha's Vineyard at a book launch party for a friend of mine, Pat Sullivan, who'd done this wonderful book on the history of the NAACP called Lift Every Voice. She'd worked 15 years on this book, and so I wanted to be there for her. And this is on a big lawn overlooking Vineyard Haven. It's I noticed this African-American woman, older, who was all by herself, and I felt kind of bad for her. So I walked over and introduced myself, and I told her that I was there in part because I was Pat's friend, but I was going to the Newport Tennis Hall of Fame to start research on my biography of Arthur Ashe. And she looks at me, she practically dropped her drink, and she said, "Well, have I got a story for you?" You know, I wasn't expecting to work at this party. You know, this wasn't supposed to be a formal interview or anything. Well, it turns out her name was Doris Kamik. And in 1955, and she was 15, she was touted as the new Althea Gibson. She was the best young black female player around. And so she was to play in this tournament in Washington, D.C., American Tennis Association. In those days, there was the U.S. Lawn Tennis Association, which was all white. Not just white clothing, but all white, right? And then the ATA, which was the black equivalent. So the ATA was having this little tournament in D.C., public court, and she comes up, Doris comes up, and the organizer comes up to her and says, "Oh, Doris, I'm so sorry. We have an odd number of girls in the draw. We have nobody to play you in the first round. However, we found this little boy," you probably know where this is going, "who said he'll play you, just like an exhibition match, an early version of Bobby Riggs against Billie Jean King, right?" And so Doris goes, "Well, how little is he?" And she's 15 now. He says, "Well, he's 11, and he's really little, but they say he's pretty good." And she's, "I'm not playing that baby. I'm playing that baby. That's ridiculous." He said, "Oh, please, don't embarrass him. He agreed to play. Just hit around with him for a while. You'll kill him, you know." And so finally, so the little black boy comes out, and he's much smaller than even she could have imagined. His arms and legs in those years were like pipe stems. I think at that point, he only weighed 70 pounds at that point. You can imagine that. So anyway, they finally prevail upon her, and of course she plays him, and he destroyed her. He just destroyed her. She hardly won a point in two sets. And she told me that was the moment she knew she was not going to be the next Althea Gibson. But so she went up to the net to congratulate him, and she said she had to reach down to be able to get his hand. And she said, the part I love is she told me, and then by this time the tears were streaming down her face, and she said, "I looked at his face and he was like the angelic assassin." The angelic assassin was a phrase she used. It's like he wasn't surprised at all. You know, he even at that age, he had this inner confidence, you know, that he beat everybody, you know. And of course, she quit tennis soon after that. But she never forgot it. You know, she never forgot it. I mean, she later became a friend of Arthur's, and it was, you know, one of these great stories that ended her tennis career. But I kept running into that, doing I did over 150 interviews for the book, and several times people would break down in tears before I even started. Cliff Drysdale, of course, the great South African expatriate, the anti-apartheid person who's Arthur's dear friend, I interviewed him in you ought to get the scene here. It's the lobby of the Waldorf Astoria, the most opulent venue you can imagine. And I'm just about to start the interview. I'm a little nervous about it. I hadn't met Cliff before. And all of a sudden he's sobbing. He gets his composure. "So I'm so sorry. This always happens to me. ESPN asked me yesterday to do an on-camera interview. And I had to say no. I just can't keep my composure when I'm asked to talk about Arthur. I said he was the greatest person I knew in my lifetime. I only wish I could have been more like him. But he had the greatest impact of anybody in my life. I kept getting that. And I thought, this guy's not just a tennis player. This is somebody who transcends the world of sports and tennis. And the final story, I'll stop, that I think Mike asked me to tell you, which is, it was a hard one to write, I have to tell you, even after writing 700 pages to get through this, because I talked to so many people about this. So it's September of 1992. Arthur's going to die in February. He's down to 128 pounds, 6'1", 128 pounds. He's a world-class athlete, you can imagine. Looked like a death camp survivor. Anyway, he grew up with this man, Randall Robinson, who became a very prominent anti-apartheid crusader later. Harvard Law School, taught at Penn State, ran this thing called TransAfrica, the leading anti-apartheid organization. Arthur helped him found it, and years before. And so anyway, Arthur's in New York, and there's a terrible problem with the first Bush administration's policy on Haitians. It's blatantly discriminatory and racist, and so they were the NAACP and TransAfrica was having a big rally at the White House. And so Randall, he knew Arthur's condition, but he thought it would be so incredible if you could be there, if you could stand there with us in front of the White House. And so Arthur's wife, Jeannie, and his doctor said, "You'd be out of your mind. You cannot go down there. You're barely hanging on here. May kill yourself." And Arthur said, "No, look, I'm going. I can't say no to Randall. He's always been there for me, and it's too important." So down he goes, and he's there with his slogan T-shirt, standing. It's a picture in my book of this, and sure enough, there are 3,000 people there, and there's one professional athlete out of the 3,000. Of course, it's Arthur Ashe. He had been advocating for athletes to speak out, sort of Colin Kaepernick style, for years, and had had limited success. But there he is. And he's arrested, one of the 100, and he's handcuffed and taken to jail, and he bails out and goes back to New York, survives it, and then has a massive heart attack the next day. Didn't kill him. He survived it. He lived long enough to die of pneumonia related to AIDS a few months later. But just I think it just speaks volumes about him as a human being, that he would do that. He wouldn't push the responsibility off to anybody else, not to a friend, to someone else, to the next generation. And as he once said, and when he was kind of reflecting on his own life relative to the civil rights movement, he said, "Look, in the early years, I did nothing. I was an image of a successful black person, but I wasn't at Selma Montgomery March, and I wasn't in the streets of Birmingham with the attack dogs and the fire hoses. I was playing at these elegant country clubs. And as he once said, as my fame rose, so did my anguish. As my fame rose, so did my anguish." And I think really the motivating principle of his life, for those last 25 years was to do everything he could. He should have lived every day like it was his last. And so I think it's a very sad story in the end. He dies at 49, like Alexander Hamilton. He never makes it to 50, right? And in fact, it's so sad that I actually walked away from the book for a year. In the middle of it, I'd already written hundreds of pages, and I thought, I don't know if I want to finish. Both my parents had just died. I was feeling older myself, immortal. I thought, do I need this? Because I know this is not going to have a happy ending. I know what's going to happen to him at the end. Can I deal with this? But I had to suck it up and realize that ultimately this is one of the most empowering stories, I think, of 20th century American history. Where he started and where he finished is we may never see it again. I hope we will. But anyway, it was much more than a sports book is the kind of thing you can write after you have tenure. You know, you don't get hired to be a sports historian. So this was a very self-indulgent book for me. But of course, it ultimately didn't turn out to be a sports book at all. Well, there's plenty of tennis in it, that's for sure. But it's about a much deeper topics of the human spirit. Thank you.
Dr. Ray Arsenault speaking last month at the Vinoy Business Alliance, audio courtesy of stpetecatalyst.com. Dr. Ray Arsenault is the John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida. He was speaking about his new book, Arthur Ashe, A Life.